Welcome to Self-Directed. We are your hosts, Cecilia and Jesper Conrad. And now it's time to welcome this week's guest.
Got it. We're live.
All right.
You do the welcoming. You okay. Always do the welcoming.
So today we're together with Martin Cook. And the thing is, we met back in Granada in 2019 in December. And beside his lovely curls and big smile.
October.
Was it October?
To be annoying.
To be annoying. It was October, not December. It felt like a good December. No, it was October. And now I got all weirded out. I will start all over. No, I will.
And you just got very attracted to him.
Yes.
Let's face it.
He's a nice man.
He's a friend.
He's a good man. Yeah. And so we talked and chilled out for some time and had a lot of fun. But what I was impressed by with you, Martin, was the day you said, hey, they have a woman's circle. Let's make a man's circle. Mm-hmm. And
what was actually more impressing was that you participated.
Yes.
Because for you, it was like something like really weird, the circle word.
Yeah, I didn't like that.
Yeah, it's funny. But because we're like real hippies, and still we don't do circles that much.
No circles. But why did you want, back then, what happened? Why were you like, hey, let's make a circle for us men?
Yeah, thanks for asking, and hello. Thanks for having me. So 3.5 years ago, we were in Granada, World Schooling Summit, and what a beautiful place to be. The connections were great. And there was a women's circle, and I was like, where's the men's? Not because I was like, where's the men's? But for a long time, I have been interested in starting a group. This is not a group I've started. That was perhaps the first circle. But it was the invitation from Lainey, who runs that, was she said, what was it? She said, it's all about saying yes. She's being open to being open. And I don't know if she quite said that, but that is now almost like a mantra of mine. I'm open to being open. And
it's funny because I say I try to be ready to be ready.
Right. Okay.
Getting ready to be ready. It's my thing. You know, now I'm ready to be ready.
Yeah.
Coffee in the morning.
right.
Please continue.
So I've thought about men's circles for a long time. I suppose my background over the last 10 years or longer, maybe 15 years, I've worked in adult mental health in the UK, specifically in helping people find work that they're passionate about. So I'd work with people who are really miserable and out of work or doing work they didn't like. And a common thread was loneliness, really. A lot of people are really lonely. And I suppose I've noticed that it's a generalization, but men perhaps find it harder to vocalize emotions more broadly. So part of my intention in thinking about men's circles and doing all that is really to address my own loneliness. I like people and connections. And I also like it when people feel like they can be vulnerable. So the thought of a men's circle, that's really, it's good stuff, really. It's creating a safe psychological space so that men can open up. So, yeah, I did have an experience with it years prior, which was really powerful. But, yeah, you were going to ask something.
Yeah, it's just you mentioned now you started something. Because all I know is the men's circle at the World School Summit 3.5 years ago. So what is it that you are doing now with it?
Oh, well, off the back of that, it's not so much that I've started a men's circle or anything like that, but it was funny because we met in the October and then the big C arrived, the corona thing.
And
a bit of background was I was traveling with my family. I've got 4 children and we were traveling around Europe. We'd actually been traveling for about 5 years 4 years prior to that. And it wasn't our intention to stop traveling, but it just so happened COVID stopped us in our tracks. Yeah. We were traveling. People often ask about world schooling and travel and how do you fund it and what do you do in your work? And our line of work, if you like, was we rented out our house in Brighton, England, south coast of England, on Airbnb. So that's what we did. But we didn't do a normal version. We did the kind of supercharged version. So every weekend we had 14 women having a hen party, which is like a bachelorette party in our house. And of course that stopped. That stopped. And then
COVID and then, kind of stopped that.
It kind of stopped that. And then then we were thinking, oh God, I'm going to have to get a job, you know, like a job. Right. But how I got back into my line of work, it came about because of an intention that I had. I for a long time too have been thinking about a podcast, and no doubt you guys weren't thinking about it just a few weeks ago. It had been bubbling.
Yeah,
away.
It's been roaming around. Yeah.
So it had been rolling around my head, and I had the perfect person. I thought, I'm going to interview this old dude. You know, he's in his late 70s, and he's really into. He's really into smoking rollies, drinking wine, women, and God. He's
perfect. I look forward to listening to that podcast.
Exactly. Yeah. So he's called Roger. And I didn't actually know whether Roger was alive. So I called an old colleague and I thought, I'll find out if Roger's alive. And this is literally when COVID's starting. I'm like, oh, I'm going to have to get a job. But I wasn't thinking about that. I was like, I want to do a podcast. Mm-hmm. And I called my old colleague and he picked up Martin. He said, are you calling about the job? I said, what job? He said, your old job. We need someone now. So within a week, I had a laptop and I started back in my line of work through the, I like to think it's kind of serendipitous. I don't know. I was thinking about something joyful.
Yeah.
And a serendipitous thing came off the back of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's very often how it is. We have this saying, what if it was easy? When things are like, when you have this, oh shit, I have to get a job, then nothing works. But if you're like, let's go do something fun, then suddenly someone's paying you money for doing it. And
and
it's just sunshine, and it's not all sunshine, but it's easy.
But goodness does flow, I think, when you are fearless. I wasn't fearful about getting a job. I thought I can just drive a van. I can do whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't had it in mind to go back to my previous work, which I really enjoyed. I really, you know, a bit of, it's interesting because I think when you travel, like, you know, people talk about identity and who are you and what do you do? You know, that kind of, what do you do?
Yeah.
And part of most people's identity can be bound up in their work.
It's a normal thing, but it is also, to be fair, what people do with their time. I mean, my answer would be I go for a long walk after lunch with my family. That's what I do. And it's a weird answer to the question, but that's what I actually do. And when you ask more normal people, people living a more mainstream life, then what they do is they do what they do at their job because that's what they do most of the hours. So it's not like a fake identity or it's real because that's really what you do.
It holds you up, doesn't it? It's part of who you are.
But it should.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a psychological, it's like if you pull that apart, it would be psychologically damaging in some cases, I think, you know?
But I think also it's real. If you get up every morning and you make bread and then you sell it, you're the baker and that's what you're actually doing.
Yeah.
So
you're
the one feeding the village or whatever, the neighborhood with bread. And you identify with this, I'm the baker, because it's real. And I think this, it can be a very fake idea to say, oh, you can't identify with your job because then you don't know who you truly are. And maybe you truly are the baker, you know?
Yeah.
I just think it's, of course, it's too bad if you know nothing else of yourself than the making bread part, the professional identity. But it's not fake to identify with what you're doing all day. I don't think so, at least.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Cecilia. We're interrupting our own podcast just to make sure that you know that I am available if you want to talk to someone who has lived the unschooling life, who has traveled the world, who has beat cancer, who has been the mother of four amazing children. Luckily, I still am the mother of four amazing children. I know about life when it's hard. I know about life when it's complicated. I know what you need is probably most of all someone who will understand the special world that you are in as an unschooling parent. Even with your trauma and your personal history getting in the way, what I do really is to be a loving support, a rock. And I do it on the base that I am a trained psychologist. I have worked with a lot of people with a lot of different situations. I am so ready to be your support, the one that you need to get some confidence and be strong in your journey as an unschooling parent. So don't hold back. I give a 20-minute conversation for free. You can talk to me on the phone or in a video call and just see if it's a match. If you want to connect, you can find me on social media or find me on my website, ceciliaconrad.com. If you're a Danish speaker, I have a Danish website, ceciliaconrad.dk, and we can find those 20 minutes and see how it goes from there. And now back to the podcast.
Yeah, it's interesting. At the moment, all day, I've stopped my work. 6 months ago, I stopped, and I've switched with my wife. And now I'm full time with the kids, so I'm looking after, feeding, cleaning, talking with, playing with, moving around the children.
So interestingly, what is your answer?
I need you to ask me. What do I do?
Right? What do you do, Martin?
Thank you. What do I do? Well, I suppose I've got lots of different hats on at different parts of the day, but I was going to say I look after the children, but that doesn't really, they mostly look after themselves, right?
Yeah. You know, they're big now. They must be.
How old? 12, 9, 7 and 4.
Yeah.
So yeah. Ish.
And, 4 is not exactly big.
No, but he'll be big.
But he's okay. Yeah.
So yeah, carer, nurturer, questioner. I'm learning a lot as well, actually. It feels like I'm going back to school, but I don't mean school in the traditional sense. But so many questions come up from just, I was just reading a book with one of my children. It was about Faraday, and you know, Michael Faraday. What did he do? And he was an inventor of, I don't know. He got it right. And then I was reading a book and he said, what's the East? Meaning the East. And then we got out the map and we started. And he said, well, it's just one big country, as we looked at Europe and Russia and all of that and all these squiggly lines that were made up. And it just, so many questions. And it's so interesting just being around children, if you allow the time and space for it, because they ask the most kind of intelligent questions.
They do.
Yeah.
And our ageism, I think, is one of the big things we have to work with as unschoolers in our deschooling process and our personal development as parents of three children. This, I was just saying to Jesper yesterday in the van, we were driving, it was late, and our sons were playing a computer game, and they read out loud what is a tail bubble in English?
Yeah.
So when there is like subtitles, they read it out loud and they make voice acting. And our youngest is 11 and he read it out loud. And I was just amazed by it, because it's in English, which is not his first language, how he just reads it out loud. It's like nothing. And he's even making the acting, and it's hard words. It's not like a little frog said hi. It's complicated stuff. It's this interesting game about psychology, and it's like really complex. And I was amazed by it, and then I had to reflect on, why am I so amazed by it? The kid has been speaking English for 5 years and he's doing this reading every day. Why am I amazed? I'm amazed because of his age. Would he have been 15? I would not be amazed.
Yeah.
And there's this ageism thing. We have this idea that because they have this age, they're supposed to, you know, the questions cannot be intelligent from a four-year-old. That's what we think.
Yeah.
Or are brought up to think. And why not?
They can be really profound because they're without looking through filters or lenses, aren't they?
They can be even unsettling. Like,
how
am I going to answer this?
Yeah. Martin, I have a question for you.
Please.
You've been a dad now for Yeah, it is based on my age. Yeah, no, I've been at that now for many years. You have been for 12 years.
Yeah.
In my life, I started out as the breadwinner, a guy with a career and different hats on, and that was part of my identity. But what I get from you is that you and your wife have switched on being who is at home. So how have you been in your masculine role? Have you ever felt the need to be, oh, I have this title? Or have you always been just cool with being hey, I'm a stay-at-home dad this now?
Yeah, I feel like I've perhaps unusually always been very comfortable in the feminine and being around women. I suppose I've been quite used to. I've got one younger sister. I wasn't the youngest of five with lots of older sisters. But yeah, no, I've never felt the kind of masculine or machismo, like I'm the breadwinner kind of thing. I've always, my wife works in IT, you know, in data. And so she's always earned a decent wage. And all the time we've been together, I've worked for charities or the NHS, that kind of thing. So I haven't earned as much. So I've been quite comfortable with that, I suppose. And yeah, I suppose I don't hang out with people with men like that. No. Is the answer in part. So I don't feel, it just feels kind of normal. Actually, one of my best friends who I've known since I was five, he for the last 4 years has been the primary carer for his children. And I've just moved house so I can walk to his house now. And it's it just feels very normal. I mean, I am interested in the role of men I'm in childbirth. I'm particularly fascinated by, having worked in mental health, it kind of feels like adult mental health, kind of feels like it's almost too late. I'm fascinated the conditions under which, well, we're conceived and birthed and then nurtured and, you know, cared for it in the sort of formative years. I find that really fascinating. And I was present at all four of the births. They're all home births, and the last two were actually free births, you'd call them. So intentionally no midwives there. But I definitely brought fear into the room as the man, and felt like I shouldn't be there. It felt like a sacred feminine thing, and it feels like it's more of a modern notion for men to be almost like a confusion that men should be there. I don't know if we looked at it anthropologically, whether men would have been there at the birth, or whether it would have been mothers, aunties, other women like that. So yeah.
I have no idea actually how it looks like from an anthropological point of view. Is there any traditions anywhere?
Yeah, I just felt like I was interfering. Like my partner had it, you know, she was there in her strength, in her feminine energy. And I wasn't going to really bring much to the party apart from a cold towel and a glass of water.
You want me to share the stories of how yes, we're really supported.
Yeah, I was there. I was good at it.
I'm not going to share that.
No. I was told that I was just kind of not getting in the way, but you know, she didn't need me. Yeah. Which is, I think that's amazing. You know, that's the feminine strength and energy. And like, I think that's absolutely amazing.
Did she have like a sister or a friend or?
No, she's quite independent.
She didn't. Yeah. But you know, maybe she would like to have a sister in the room or.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, yeah, she hasn't got a sister. And she recently said, oh, it'd be really nice to have a sister, you know, to understand understand each other.
Yeah.
Have you got a sister?
I've got three.
Have you? Okay.
Yeah. Well, it's complicated.
Like
because of an early divorce, I have like step and half and yeah. So maybe I only have two. Depends on how you look at it. I have two that I'm really close with that feels like sisters. Yeah. And I also have just as many brothers. So I'm like.
Big family.
Blessed. Yeah. Well, it's two families.
Yeah.
Because my parents, they were divorced when I was 4 or 5, and they found the right one right after, and both of them married more children. So they found someone who also had children. So when very early in my life, I had all these siblings or half siblings, or I just call them siblings. Yeah. And then my mother and her new husband got one more child. So I have like one. I don't really care about the whole gene thing. It's more about the feeling.
Yeah.
And some feel more like siblings than others. But...
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, just a short interruption as I have a small message about some of the things I'm working on. My name is Jesper Conrad. It is my pleasure to invite you to become a less stressed dad. I know how it is to be stressed out. My wife, I had cancer. I have 4 kids and I had a long career and had to like juggle everything at the same time. And it's hard. It's sometimes hard to be a dad. It's hard to be the breadwinner, if that's what you are. That's what I've been in our family, where my wife have been at home with our children. And it takes its toll. And one of the things that really help is to talk with someone else about it. And that is why I've created the Better Dad Institute together with my good friend Martin Cook. And at the Better Dad Institute, we have dad circles where we meet up once a week and just talk about life as a dad, because sharing actually is super, super healing in the process of being a dad. To just hear that someone else is working through the same problems that you are is very, very giving. And if you're into more like a one-on-one thing, then I would happily help you and share my experience of being a dad to 4 wonderful children and having a wonderful relationship with my wife and being a full-time travel dad, how I have juggling everything at the same time, having a career, and how I have learned to get those shoulders down to actually be very happy in my life. Of course, the stress can like pop up, but then I have the techniques I've learned and which I would love to teach you. So reach out at the betterdadinstitute.com. And if you want to get directly in contact with me, then it's betterdadinstitute.com/Conrad. I look forward to hearing from you and have fun. And now on with the podcast.
Yeah.
I would love to return to the masculinity part. And I am a very pink kind of guy, love colors, and I'm very happy with flowers. I love to run over to flowers and smell them. But if you just look at me, then...
And you're like very, very fascinated by romantic movies.
Oh, yes.
Oh, and really?
I like romantic movie and everything.
Can't stay awake.
But if you just look at me and I wasn't smiling, you, due to my size, would think, oh, that's kind of a man's man. But I'm very little a man's man. So back to this circle we had on the World Schooling Summit, we were sitting and talking about some of our vulnerabilities. And one of mine back then, we still... had an idea if we should drive in the big red bus we had. I talked and I was like, but I'm so afraid that it will break down. And there was and I mentioned in this circle that I was really fascinated by men who, you know, can fix an engine. For me, that's like magic. I don't know how they do it, but I'm very impressed
by it. Me too. It's incredible. It's like witchcraft. Yeah.
Yeah. They got grease on their hands and sweaty and sexy and all that. No, but it's
you know,
it's not sexy to me.
No, but it's fascinating for me that they know how it works and how it fits together. And I talked with one of the guys in the circle about how I was afraid to even touch my engine on this big red bus we had. And he said something to me we have used as an advice later. He said, don't worry, you cannot fuck it up as much as a professional cannot fix it later on.
Right.
And well, we say it nicer.
We say it nicer.
We say you can't break it so much, no one can fix it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, if it's broken already, you can give it a go, and then if it still doesn't work, well, it didn't work to begin with, and then you call the mechanic.
Yeah, but I've actually used that and then have changed something on the big old machine and tried to do it myself. I'm still afraid of it, but trying to do it was a nice accomplishment to remove the fear of breaking everything.
Yeah.
So how is this, you know, how is it? because you started this out as a masculinity question. And what I think is it would be very healthy for you to let go of the idea that a real man should be able to fix the motor. I mean, let's just call the mechanic and not waste our time because we don't know what we're doing. I don't know what you don't know. It would be really feminine to know about, I don't know, fashion or nail polish, some things I don't know, you know. And you be you and I be me. And...
Yeah, yeah, but in kind of...
It's like put, it's two things.
It's, it, yeah, but it's put down the true... I've been programmed by society to think that men should be able to fix stuff when I was young.
Yeah, yeah, no, well, it's a really... I think it's a really important observation that society, well, thinks that it's a masculine thing. And it shouldn't be that, should it? It shouldn't be at all. It's not a gendered thing.
Statistically, more men are interested in motors than women. So yeah. I think it comes from that. But that doesn't mean that all men are interested in motors. And it definitely doesn't mean that all men are able to fix one.
No.
I'm terrible with motors and DIY and things like that. You know, and we've just bought a new house and it's really old and everything's broken. You know, like all the windows are rotting. It needs just had a new boiler where, you know, we've got a digger out the back. We're having an extension built. And I would love to get involved and do things. And I changed a lock on a shed last week. And I thought, yes, I'm doing it. It's in the rain. I've got the wrong drill. And then I triumphantly closed it and realized that I'd managed to screw it in wrong. So it's permanently locked again. Even without a lock, I'm just so terrible at DIY. So I was telling the builders just yesterday. I said I was telling this story, and I'm kind to myself now, definitely. But it's been a long journey of realizing that it's not so much. Yeah, we can't be good at everything, can we? And
I've realized with all these DIY things that, well, we talk about all this maintaining the house and fixing the motor. It's an education. And we should like really value that.
I'm loving.
Some people don't have it. If you don't have the education, none of us have had any interest in building tables or fixing motors in our lives. And we're closing in on 50 now. I mean, maybe we should just face it. Other people do that. And we have other stuff that we're good at because we've been interested in it and been doing it all of our lives. You can't just build a drawer.
Yeah.
Out of nowhere, you know, people who do that, they have learned from someone and they've spent a lot of time learning.
Yeah.
And that comes back to the whole education question where we have this traditional, very wrong idea that academics are the high ranking. That's what takes some intelligence and hard work. And all the things you do with your hands, it's more like, you know, anyone can do that and it doesn't really matter. But we're losing respect to people who can do something that we all three can't do. And we really need people who can do it. So
I have a lot of respect for people who can do things that are practical. And indeed, we've actually consciously moved so as to be closer to a place that we're quite heavily involved in. Local to us in East Sussex, the county of East Sussex. It's called Wilderness Woods. So it's a wood that was bought about 10 years ago by a couple who were traveling around Europe looking for a place of land to be with their children. And she's interested in alternative education. And what happens there are there are about 30 young people, like under our age, who live there and work there for free. So that, like woofing, so they live on the land, but they volunteer some of their time, but they also make things there. So they make the drawer, the table, there's a potter, you know, there's people that cook, and it's a community, and our children have lessons there. So my daughter now is just doing green woodworking. So she's learning practical skills.
Beautiful. Lovely.
Which is so nice. And I was just going to say, I think as a child, it depends on what you experience, right? As what you're around. I didn't have people that I was around that were showing me things. I mean, my dad did oversee building a house. He managed the whole thing. He wasn't laying the bricks, but I was around that. So that did give me a kind of it has given me the desire to want to do that myself. I have this desire to want to build something. And so this thing out the back that we're building is a small version. Maybe in 20 years time, Charlie and I and my wife will build a little place in Scotland, probably. Mm. My ancestry is Scottish, so I like the idea of somewhere wild with a fire, very warm, enclosed. And I'll be involved in building it somehow, but mm-hmm. I know that I'm not going to be a builder, and that's fine. That's fine. And
it's fine, yeah.
I was actually invited. I studied psychotherapy, and perhaps like lots of people who study psychotherapy, when you train as a psychotherapist, you have to be in therapy yourself. And I couldn't just give myself permission just to go into therapy. It was a legitimate thing. I had to do it. So I spent many years in therapy. And I remember early on feeling very upset about the fact that I couldn't change a lock or do anything, you know, crying about it, being really mm-hmm. like, why am I such a failure? Mm-hmm. And the therapist, he just gave me permission. He just said, you can't be good at everything. That's why we all do different things. You're really good at these things. Just pay someone to do that.
Mm-hmm. And exactly.
It was like, oh, it just gave me the permission to be kind to myself and to realize that we're not good at everything.
No, we don't have to.
Martin, how did you get into the whole traveling with your kids and alternative education? Because you have kind of stepped a lot outside the normal road from that is otherwise people travel.
So if I start, I'm about 14, 15. I've all my family work in IT. I see the trappings. I think money. I want a BMW. I'm going to study IT. So off I go to university. I've got my grades. I've been a good boy. I've been educated, but really I know nothing. It's all gone in here and out here. I've remembered it. And I traveled for the first time when I left university. Actually, no, it was in a placement year. I went to America and I was caught up in 9/11, actually. I was in Washington when the planes hit, and I'm really passionate about photography. So photography gave me a reason to travel, really. Or it gave me something to do. You know, when people say, what are you doing? Oh, I'm traveling. I needed the more permission to be traveling in a valid way. I couldn't just be, as you said, going for a long walk after lunch. That'd be too indulgent.
Yeah. So it took me some years, but that is actually what I'm doing.
Exactly. Good for you. You know, that's loving, nurturing, and the ripple effect of that, mm-hmm. it just goes out into the universe, doesn't it?
And, it does. Yeah.
And I would,
continue the story you were, so, yeah.
Yeah, I needed photography to allow myself just to be, just to come like a, I suppose like a butterfly comes out of the chrysalis. You know, I was like the caterpillar all trapped at university thinking, I hate this. I just don't want to do IT. It doesn't. I'm not very good at it, and it doesn't feed my soul with anything great. And I was really confused about the money side of things as well. I saw all the money, but I kind of knew internally, so it was a conflict. And so traveling and just being still with no purpose. This is when I'm 21, 22, 23. It really was the first opportunity to sit in that stillness and kind of find myself. And I went when I was 23, I went on this charity expedition called Rally International. It's a charity in the UK and they run adventure projects and community projects around the world. So I went to Borneo for 3 months and it was a really, really formative experience. I was 23 and most of the people there were 17, 18. So I guess I was an elder amongst the younger ones. And it was there that I found my vocation, really, which was, you know, we'd be on a building site in the rainforest building this library, and all these kind of 17, 18 year olds who were off to university, I really identified with them because I'd kind of been there, and I just found myself listening to a lot of them, and I just really enjoyed that kind of listening role. Yeah. And I guess I always think about jobs in terms of the village. You know, what would we have done? There would have been a baker, wouldn't there? And there'd have been a magician, and there'd have been the woodworker and the this and then that. And I think my role, what do? I'm a listener and I'm a connector. I really love to connect people up and join the dots between people. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I really enjoyed listening to young people. And I came back with the passion for photography and almost immediately I said, right, I want to go and be staff for this charity. I want to go and volunteer again, but as running the project. And so I went back as a staff photographer in Costa Rica and Nicaragua. And I was given a Land Rover and my camera, and they said, go off and photograph the two countries. And that was for 3 months. And it was amazing, you know, getting stuck, you know, in the Land Rover down swampy lanes and getting towed out, and just stories abound, experiences. And that's where I met my wife. So day one, I'm photographing everyone getting off the bus for a little ID card, and Charlie walks off, and she'd just quit her job 6 months prior, had been traveling around Asia and was doing this thing, and we met and we traveled afterwards. So Charlie and I met traveling. Yeah. So that was, I suppose, both of our DNA. We got traveling, and it wasn't a conscious thing to travel with our children. But sometimes life has to get tough to, or rather we consciously or subconsciously engineer the conditions to make our life more difficult in order to push or guide ourselves towards our true path, I think. So we were living in London. We were visiting Brighton every weekend. Oh, Brighton's great. It's on the south coast. It's a great city. Why don't we move there? So we moved there, but I was still working in London, commuting, you know, 2 hours each way.
Oh, shit.
Right? So you've got a three-year-old and you've got a little 18-month-year-old, and Charlie looks at me and she said, what are we doing? Why are we doing this? But we made it difficult. And then we had to think, right, we need to improve this situation. Mm. What can we do? And she said, we could rent our house out and go traveling. I said, are you mad? Like, you know, like,
what? This sounds like a story we've had.
Right.
Tried that.
Yeah.
Are
same conversation.
Yeah. I'm definitely, so Charlie's like the visionary, like anything's possible. And I'm sort of not, but I'll go along for the ride. Once I'm in it, I'm like, I'm there. So she said, but I'm sort of coming up with problems like, how will we afford to travel, right? As everyone, you know, we'll rent our house out. And I said, but it'll only just cover the bills and the mortgage. She said, no, we'll rent our house out to holiday makers because they come to Brighton all year round. It's very, very busy. And I said, okay, all right, get the person round. We'll find out how much money we could get. And it was like, let's say it was £2,000-£3,000 a month. It still wasn't enough to travel. I thought, well, no. So she says, I've got this man who's coming round. He does hen parties. And have you heard of a hen party or a bachelor?
Yeah, I know what it is. Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, it's basically a massive raucous party where, you know, like the caricature of it is women walking around with like learner plates on and short skirts and being loud and all that kind of thing, letting their hair down. And Charlie said, there's this guy coming who doesn't do holiday homes. He does holiday homes just for hen parties. I said, no way. No way. What? Like, and at the time I thought it'd be like eight women because we only had a three-bedroomed house. It was quite tall and thin, but he arrives and he's a geezer. He was like, you know, in his flash car, and he starts walking around our house, and I'd already decided no way. And he's counting people. He's looking at the floor and going 2, 4, 8. And I was like, what's he doing? He's counting how many women he can fit in our house. And 14 was the number, and we did it. We went with Hen Man, as he was called. We did that for a year, and he didn't pay us on time. The house was a state. When we got back from our first travels, which was we went to Southeast Asia, so we had friends in Bangkok, soft landing, and then we went up through Thailand and Cambodia, and then we were in Bali for 2 months. We stayed in a beautiful, we just through connections, Facebook, you know, we found lovely guy who was traveling back to the States, and he sublet his basically a bamboo house open, you know, snakes and monkeys and in Bali. And we were there for a couple of months. It was amazing, but it was also hard. I think it's really important, as I think you said, you got ill on the road recently, right? And I think this is, and I've totally been there. You know, anyone who's traveled for any length of time is going to get ill. It's a thing. Well,
it happens sometimes.
It happens. It does happen.
We realized this virus we had was actually all over Sicily.
Right. Yes. Yeah,
so it was not just us. It was just because, you know, at the moment there's this virus around and we get it as well.
Yeah. So, yeah. But there's a kind of duality to to everything. Like people think, oh, you're traveling, you're having like your best life. And it's like, no, we're just living. Like we're trying to live our best life. And
our premise is different because it's not in one place. It's not a house. And the advantages are quite obvious. I mean, I've just been walking alongside blossoming trees, almond trees, looking at the snow at the top of the mountains here in Italy this morning with my teenage daughter. It was beautiful. But yesterday, you know, we were just roaming around looking for a place to park our van with in some weird, it's not always amazing. Amazing is easy to describe and it's easy to take pictures of, but the real life that we bring, and maybe we could call it obstacles or disadvantages, they're a little harder to describe.
But photographs are nice. You know, I felt really conscious when we traveled. You know, Charlie said, oh, we can have a better income traveling because we'll do a blog, we'll be vloggers and things like that. And I just kind of felt like that wasn't the thing because it wouldn't allow us to show a balanced, or I don't know how many, well, some vloggers do, but I did a very small photo stream just for an extended group of family and friends. And I would take pictures of like when we were in Bali, we went to New Zealand and we bought a van in New Zealand. It was an old VW Westphalia pop top. It was really, really cool. And
I know that one.
You know, it was brown with the checkered thing on the side.
Beautiful. Yeah.
It was beautiful. And it was left hand drive. And it was, And everybody, my friend Tim, who lived there, he said, you really shouldn't buy this van because it's a Volkswagen and all the parts come from Europe and we're here right next to Japan. You should buy a Toyota. But there was a romance. You know, we wanted the van. The van turned up. It had a lovely story. And so I drive the van 6 hours, but I flew and then I drive it back and we put all our savings. So we put like £8,000 of savings into the van to live in. I drive it back 6 hours and Tim, and it was like this, it's like mountains of New Zealand. Yeah. And he said, it's an old van. It was like 38 years old or however old it was. He's like, you've got to take it easy. Just do like 50 miles an hour. Stop every couple of hours. Check the van. I was too excited. I just drove at like 65 miles an hour flat out. Triumphantly came home with the van. And then the next day I drove into town and I park up and it's rear engine, water cooled vehicle. Park up. And there's all water pissing out the back of the van. I was like, oh, what have I done? I've ruined, we're going to live in it. It's too expensive to live in New Zealand. We have to be in a van. You know, we haven't got the money coming in from the hen house. In my head, we're screwed. I've made the biggest mistake of my life. It's awful. And so what happens, of course, when you take a risk, you get rewarded. And I start ringing around. I was like, right, I need the VW Owners Club for New Zealand. And I start speaking to all these old dudes on the phone. And this name kept coming up. Oh, you want to speak to this guy called Marty? He lives in Blah. And I look where Blah is, and it's 10 miles away from where we're staying on a farm with our friends. And it turns out this guy's got six of them in his garden. He's an aircraft engineer. What he doesn't know about this particular model, like he's like the best of the best. Yeah. And he spends the next 2 weeks every evening with me. He's working during the day. Every evening, I camp in his garden in the thing. Because he's showing me how to fit a new cam belt, and I'm just kind of nodding just because thanks. And he's like you'll need these tools. So I like buy the tools thinking I'll never use these, like it, but he was really, and what a beautiful man, he really wanted to make sure that the engine didn't crap out on us, as he described it. I don't want it to crap out on you, but he wanted us to see his country that he was really proud of, and he was just a really beautiful human being, and I'll never forget his kindness and love in doing that. And it really, yeah, that was, and the van was perfect from that day onwards, and the whole engine could have blown up if all the water had gone. It would have
exploded.
All gone.
I like that one, when you take a risk you get rewarded. We really every time we've been in these, it really resonates with me, this, you know, now everything is falling apart, this feeling something happens and you're like, okay, this is the end of the road. Then something happens.
Yeah.
Always something happens. There's always someone to help. Like, totally. Right? Like, totally, like, when, next to you. Then they come themselves.
You can't be tough with it. Like, you've got to be vulnerable with it. And yes, you've got to surrender.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's like you've got to let the love in, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know.
We just had a flat tire, and the story is the exact same.
Really?
Exact same story. Yeah. We had a flat tire in Sicily.
Right.
And first,
the only day it was raining, but we got a warning sign. So we drove in, parked under, so we wouldn't get wet. And like.
But the thing that happened was, first we tried with all the insurance and calling and handling it ourselves.
Yeah.
Because actually there was a guy coming. Like, should he help us? And we were like, no, we'll figure it out. And then after like 20 minutes of phone calls and WhatsApp and what have you, I said to this rescue lady on the phone who couldn't like understand the address, and I told her, you know, I'll call you back. And then I went and talked to that guy who wanted to help us. He was right there. He was still right there, and said, you know, in my Italian, which I don't speak, thank you very much. I would like to receive your help. And from that moment, it was like this. And we had new tires and fresh coffee, everything. Yeah.
But you've consciously chosen to take yourself out of your comfort zone.
Exactly.
By saying goodbye to a traditional life. And I think that's where I love the film The Matrix, you know. Mm. But the film The Matrix perfectly describes for me the conditioning and the world that most people are living in. And when you can see the Matrix and you consciously choose to uncouple from it, life does become more difficult on many levels. But it's also not difficult. It's almost as it should be.
First guy who showed up to help us the first time, maybe it was the second, one of the first times, the big red bus broke when we were traveling. Yeah. One of the first guys who, of course, there was a mechanic right across the street who could fix an old timer, of course. Yeah. And he came to help us. And this little part that, you know, hasn't been in production for 35 years, he managed to replace it.
He knew how to find it.
Or to fix it or whatever. And when he left, I noticed on the sleeve of his T-shirt, it said Angel. It did.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, universe, you're talking to me, and I'll try to like adjust the listening device. Yeah.
So let's talk about what this is then. Would people have people ever described you as lucky?
Oh yeah.
Right. I think this is fascinating. Right. So the extent to which you feel or one feels that you can make your own luck. There's I personally believe you can make your own luck. I mean. But just because I've had a lot of lived experience of having these lucky connections or, you know, what people would perceive as very fortunate. But I think it's when you're in a flow state and on the right path, things just kind of come to you, don't they?
It's not luck.
So how can we share how to increase your luck?
We have a friend of Chris.
It's complicated. Okay, we won't go there.
Let's do it. I love complicated. I'm not going to do it like in one tweetable sentence.
No, but our friend Chris has a nice saying, and it is about being in tune with the universe.
Is it the intention, attention, no tension?
That is also good. But it's not that one I was thinking about.
That's a good general rule, that to be aware of your intention. Like, what is it? What kind of life do you want? What kind of emotions do you need to like get rid of? Or what is it we're looking for? To be intentional and to be able to describe it quite clearly, to know what sounds wrong if I say to know what you want, because that could be like, I want a BMW or whatever. It's more like, it's a more emotional thing, actually.
What does your heart desire?
Yeah. And how do I want to feel? It's not about what do I want to have. So that's the intention. And then there's the attention. You have to be, you know, you have to take it when it comes. You have to be ready to be, you know, oh, that's where it is.
It's like, perhaps I've never surfed, but it's perhaps like watching the wave and knowing, like, I want that big wave. And it's having the attention to see that it's coming.
You
knowing it's scary.
Yeah, well, you have to look at the ocean if you want that big wave.
Yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise, yeah. No, if it's there, you have to. So that's the attention. And then there's the no tension, which is the hard part, I think, is to let go of the whole thing. Like, I'm okay either way. I'm happy. Oh, is it the this or something better you wanted to say?
No.
Because that's actually the no tension is, you know, I'm happy with this, or it could be something better.
Is it no attention or no tension?
No tension.
Right. So,
it's intention. You start with intention. Yeah. You continue with attention. You do your part and you're sure that you're looking at the ocean.
Yeah.
If it's the wave you're looking for. And then you have no tension. You're not like very attached to the idea that it has to be right now, or it has to be perfect, or it has to be in this special way, or it has to happen. If it's not happening, I'm not doing it right. Chill.
Your tension will block the universe.
It being in the flow state.
Or you without narratives. I use the word narratives quite a lot when I'm working with people. Mm-hmm. They will use language about themselves, like, I'm not good at this, or I should do this, or I should do that. And being aware of what your narratives are, because the narratives are quite powerful. They can have quite a powerful hold over you, I think. And that can get in the way of the universe sorting things out beautifully for you. It can get in the way of your luck. Almost.
But they get in the way of your attention, because your narrative actually is the filter that you look at the world. So you can't actually see it when it happens if you have the wrong quote unquote narrative going on.
We actually have a thing that is down the same line, which we call, when you do what is difficult, life becomes easy. And sometimes we take it when we are super hungry and we live on this vegan, gluten-free diet.
Yeah,
on the road,
and it's super hard. But then you go into a supermarket, and if you are into organic produce, then it's very easy. You don't have to.
You buy the five things they have, and then you eat them.
And then you walk out of the supermarket. It's actually kind of easy. You don't need to take stand on all these hundreds and hundreds of things that are in a supermarket. It's like, okay, these three, there we go.
It's a very simple example of, if you do what is hard, your life becomes easy.
Yeah.
And it's also what you describe, this process of actually making things very complex. And sometimes, you know, you ended your story at Bali, I think, in a accommodation, maybe not perfect.
Yeah. Or
beautiful and adventurous and lovely to share stories about afterwards, but maybe it was no fun actually living there.
No, it was absolutely. So we were in this hut. It wasn't a hut. It was a enclosed, and it's three bedrooms upstairs and then downstairs, traditional Balinese, just tiled floor and out into the garden. Mm-hmm. And I pretty much went mad there. So, you know, like if I was on Instagram,
for me to imagine,
it would look amazing. Like, it would look amazing. Mm-hmm. But the reality was, and it was amazing, you know, we'd get this takeout, delicious food would come. This little man would come down the gate, who was in the middle of nowhere, backing onto this jungle, and he would shout Bali Buddha and bring this, you know, beautiful salad every evening for no money. And, you know, there was a cleaner and she was sweet and it was all like really nice. And I got a little car. Hired a car and we drive to this drumming circle, and it was like really great. And everyone who would have heard about it would have heard all of that. But the thing that made me go mad were the ants. I don't know if you've been to Asia, but like, imagine you've got two children, right? And they're eating a bit of bread or a bit of porridge in the morning. And if you didn't clean every single little crumb,
in the second it touches the floor, you remove it.
You've got like a whole motorway of ants. I'd come down in the morning and I'd be sweeping them up, and I was just kind of going mad with it. And Charlie didn't care. She was like, you just sweep them up, who cares? Whereas in my head it was really interesting. I started meditating upon it. What is it the ants are trying to tell me? I think in retrospect they were trying to tell me, here we go, you cannot control life. It's an illusion to think that you are in control of anything. And surrender is key. And here's me trying to change the jungle. Yeah. I'm living in the jungle. Even if I had walls and doors, they'd have been underneath anyway.
Oh, but
like, here's me trying to like sweep up every evening. Rather than doing some yoga, I'd be like downstairs for an hour, like cleaning everything. And so I think the lesson there was that you'll go mad if you try and control the ants, everything.
But it is this, this, like the narratives you described before, you had this narrative or this idea that ants equals not clean or not looking good enough after your family or something.
Yeah, like I was being invaded. I was having dreams about them. It's horrible, you know.
But you have to remove that idea.
Yeah.
To surrender to the jungle and
it was
and the happiness that was readily available.
It's only when it's only almost right towards the end of something that I realized, you know, it's like when it's ending, I can see the beauty in it. And when I've left, you know, so, yeah, so.
Maybe that's a good thing. I mean, maybe we take with us the good memories.
Yeah.
As long, I hope you can see some beauty while
and,
it's going
and the
on.
Lessons, the lessons learned throughout it. Yeah, we actually returned to New Zealand 2 years after that and had the same experience of buying a van, but this time with less money in the bank and another child. So, you know, we needed a bigger and better van, and what we got was a smaller and worse van. And if anybody's in the market for a smaller and worse van, it's the Mazda Bongo with the pop top. Don't get it. So, we've got
but Martin, about your kids and schooling, why haven't you just sent them to school? Why not choose the normal way of doing things?
I like to think about first principles and what does success look like, right? And the first, the most important question I think for me is what is a life well lived? How do you live well? And so I suppose in part schooling has come about as a result of my a substandard school experience. I wasn't very happy at school. Not that I was depressed, but I just didn't, you know, I was not in with the cool crowd. I wasn't like on all the football teams having my best life. You get some children and they seem to really thrive in schools in that environment, and that's great. But I was quite shy and I was quite academic, but I certainly struggled in some subjects. And so I think I've carried that through, that kind of belief that it wasn't great. And we didn't feel like our first child was ready. Not that she was ready. In the UK, you're in school at 4 years old, way too early. And we looked around, and you can see that obviously in Europe there are countries where it's six or seven, and we just like arbitrary numbers, like you were saying, you know, you're ready now, you're four. Just like they say, right, you're ready.
Another kind of ageism.
Exactly. You should have given birth after 40 weeks. You know, so that's the gestation period. But in other countries, it's 39 weeks. So you're late, you know, so we're going to inject you full of drugs and force the child out of you. So there's so I suppose it feeds into questioning systems and so firsthand experience and then questioning systems of kind of control and power and also asking, looking forward. So I suppose like consciously thinking, what are the skills that are going to be required to thrive in life? And for me, that's emotion, like grounded emotion, being able to express your emotions and feeling like you have choice and autonomy, because we assume that most adults do, and yet we somehow feel that it's okay to essentially imprison children from the age of four with no choice. Oh, you're enjoying art. Next lesson. You know, I remember school, we had an activity week at school where if you had money, you'd go off skiing, and we didn't have money that year. So I spent a week in the art class. But usually art was half an hour. And then, so I thought I was terrible at art. I loved it for a whole week. I could just get in really into something. So I could deep dive, and I really enjoyed that. I just really remember it. So the feeling that you don't get the opportunity to deep dive and follow your interests. And so that's kind of how we've got to home education. I wouldn't call it unschooling. There's definitely it's always on my mind, perhaps more so my wife's mind, that it's a tension between getting some grades that are going to be useful to open up doors if you did want to go on and get a degree as an architect, or if you wanted to, whatever you want to do. So there's a tension between like not doing any exams or doing some exams. And so I'm tasked with the laptop is propped on a book here. I thought I'd prop it on this book so I could mention it. Not really. Teach your child to read in 100 easy lessons. That's the book that's under the laptop now. And thinking about what is my role, I'm here to teach them how to read and maths. I'm getting into maths, even with the kind of nine-year-old, to use these labels. It's difficult for me. I'm back to school. Can I do it? I don't have to do everything. At the Woods, there's a maths teacher. I can outsource bits of it. It's kind of, I think the, don't they say a child needs, or we all need a village. You know, it takes a village to raise a man, right? Yeah. I'm not good at everything. And that's why I want my children to be surrounded by happy, grounded adults and children of all ages who are kind of,
yeah, I want to go to that forest.
Yeah.
Like really nice.
It's super cool. It's really great. And the people that run it are really, they say yes. And they say, yeah, like I've just set up on a Sunday, something called Sunday Sessions with somebody who lives there. She's got this health hut and we're running a circle where people can just come in and we're just kind of shaping it however the people that turn up do it, right? So they said yes to my friend here who wanted to set up a food business. They said, yeah, just test it out. Mm-hmm. You know, because they know how important it is for people to do stuff they're passionate about. So I think back to your question, which was how come homeschool?
You didn't choose school. Yeah.
I think it's broken as a system. I think it serves the few, you know. Yeah. And it's a form of imprisonment at its most extreme, or you know.
No, I totally agree. I don't find it extreme. It is a prison.
Yeah, it is a prison. And so I'm interested in nurturing free thinking individuals who have autonomy over their own minds and bodies and how they choose. And I'm not perfect. I'm you know, none of us are. We're not, you know, like I suppose you might say you'll be judged on your results, you know, but define success. Yeah, right.
It's not fun for a child to be your result.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I should be able to define myself and judge myself and let myself be judged on who I am. And
that's a really good point.
On what they are capable of.
But I think
that's very important.
There's a really big culture of how your kids are doing, you know? So, oh, my children have got these grades. They're off to this university. Yeah. They've got this job.
My son's a doctor.
Yeah. And
good on him, not on me.
So what? Is he happy? Are you happy?
Yeah.
How do you live well?
How's your relation with that son?
Yeah. Yeah.
Can I? I'm sitting on something. Can I give you?
Yeah, please. What again?
One piece of advice on the reading thing. Yeah. The reading thing. I'm very passionate about it because it took me forever to learn how to teach kids to read.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And my best advice is this: don't do it.
Right.
Please. You read them stories because you like stories. You read books yourself because you want to read the book. Yeah. Reading is a culture. But do not teach the children. Yeah. And they learn like this. It's crazy. I've seen it in real life. Right, and I wouldn't believe it. We had in our story as home educators, we had a great failure with our first.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Like huge, like in shit.
He got stubborn and didn't want to learn to read.
Got angry and decided that he would never learn to read.
Yeah.
And what would we do about it? And well, basically, he finally decided to learn to read, and then he learned. But it was not because I was helping him. It was his decision. And he was, I think, 13 at the time, he decided. And it was because there was this book he wanted to read.
Yeah.
He was listening to audiobooks because he couldn't read, and he didn't mind. And he had decided never to learn to read. And because we had pushed him in the wrong way.
Yeah.
At the wrong time, in the wrong context. And he decided to learn to read as when he was 13, because there was this audiobook, and book two was not available as audio.
Yeah.
And the thing was, it was not even translated into Danish. And the book was so interesting, he decided, I need to learn to speak English, and I need to learn to read a book. So he did. And he did it in like 2 months.
Yeah.
After hardly, you know, he could hardly read his own name.
Can I ask you a question then? Where did your motivation to, let's say, push or to get him to, where was that coming from?
From me and society.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
No, actually, first, because we have a 23-year-old. Mm-hmm. And so this first I'm talking about is the first home-educated child who is now 17. And 23-year-old, she was in a free school in Copenhagen, very, very free and lovely school. And we thought our second child would be in that school.
Yeah.
So closing in on the time that he would start in school, I realized that he's a very spiritual child, very highly sensitive, very much himself. He's not weak. It's not weakness. It's just he's in his own state. And I thought learning to read plus learning to be in school will be too much for him.
Yeah.
So I'll teach him to read before he starts. And the context of that is that me and my siblings all learned to read when we were 4 or 5 years old. And our oldest child learned to read when she was 5. So for me, it was not a thing. In Denmark, you start when you're 6.
Yeah.
So when he was 5, I thought, okay, I'll just, you know, teach him to read. It'll take me like 2 weeks and that's it. So he got annoyed with that. And then when he didn't start schooling, Jesper said that, okay, you can homeschool, but then he has to learn to read.
Yeah.
So I knew if I'm not teaching.
Anxiety, you know, of other people's judgment on you when you do something that is out of the ordinary. When you homeschool, it's like, ooh, what would people think?
So you wanted them to, like,
what would the neighbor say? Kind of feeling inside.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And what's interesting also is when couples, when we come together and we come at it from slightly different angles, or we come at it with our own stuff, don't we?
Of course.
And
obviously. And I'm not very nice, to be honest. I'm like so much.
Come on, what do you mean?
And so I'm not nice. I'm not.
She's very nice, but powerful.
But I'm not. I'm not compliant, and I'm not like going to obey things to be nice. I'm nice because I like people. Yeah. And I like to be in a state of love and compassion and taking care of each other, but I'm not nice in order to be nice or to be perceived as nice. And that way I'm not nice. I do my thing and there is nothing that will stop me. And that's why I call myself an anarchist, because a rule will not stop me from doing what I believe is right.
Yeah.
I just know this. So, and he's very nice. My husband is a very nice guy. He wants everybody to feel good. And if that, you know, he's just, you know, he's very nice. And I think that's the very big difference in that situation. When we started to homeschool, I was, you know, I wouldn't care less what the world around me would think about the situation. But he was kind of not afraid, but
no,
you wouldn't
also
bother to feel safe.
Also the one being out in the world gives another pressure on you when you go to work and you meet people and they're like, oh, you homeschool, but the first question you get is, can they read and they write? Well, it's a little different pressure when you are at home with the children, of course.
Yeah.
But
no, but then okay, I'm just trying to interfere with your reading process with your children, actually.
Yeah, you're a disruptor. I like this. Yeah.
I'm not nice, as I say. No, I'm just saying, like, in my personal experience as a home educator, once I let go of this teaching them how to read, they learned to read, like, so smoothly. The two last ones, so the third child, she learned to read while I was trying to teach the other one to read. She got interested, and she could read when she was 4. And she read her first full novel when she was, like, 6 or 7.
Right.
So, and she did it on her own. I didn't even teach her the alphabet. I mean, I answered the questions when she asked me something, but it was not a teaching situation and I had no agenda. And my fourth child, he learned to read when he was 8. And I got a little butterflies in the stomach there because I was like, is this another late reader? Because I'm okay with it, but it's a little complicated with the world. It is complicated with people around you when you unschool, you live in a bus and walk barefoot and then the kids can't read. You know, it can get you into trouble. So we were observing the situation with some emotion involved. But what happened was that he started reading in three languages.
Right.
So once he started, he could read in English, Danish, and Spanish, which is not the same system.
So it took longer time.
So obviously it took longer time.
Yeah.
And now he's the one I described yesterday, reading out loud, doing voice acting in his second language. So, and what my point is, it's like teaching them to walk. You don't teach your children to walk. You hold their hand for a while if they stretch out their arm, hopefully.
They see you walking and they observe.
They see you walk. Everybody's walking, so they walk. At some point, they get up and walk. And because we live in a culture of text and language, written language and books, and also on the computer, the internet, everything, there's so much text everywhere. They learn to read.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, it's...
And the lessons are not helping. That's my point.
Yeah.
Lessons are not helping. The lessons are making the kids feel stupid. Whereas put them on your lap and read them a good story that makes them feel loved and that reading is something amazing. And then they suddenly they can read.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. I think my wife has more of the judgment when you were talking there. It's like, it's the judgment of others. And I give less of a shit, but I'm probably in between the two of you or where you both were. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it is a difficult thing that I think all of us need to face. And when you choose a life different than what is the norm, then you are more aware of that. Oh, am I doing this because of what other people would say or think about me?
Yeah. What's driving the, you must be able to do this by this age.
That's how we started identifying as unschoolers, because we realized that all the quote-unquote teaching we did, we actually did it because we were afraid of the system, the school system that would come and check on us.
It's and the same we were, in the UK. Yeah.
But my fear...
As families, mother-in-laws, mothers.
I was not afraid of your mother.
No.
I was afraid because they have real power.
Yeah.
They could actually interfere with our life. Your mother, she's nice.
Absolutely.
So, the thing was, I was afraid that the school system would come and check on us and find it not good enough and start forcing us into the school system or to do things we didn't want to do. So every day, I thought I would teach the children. Most days I didn't, and I felt guilty about it. And some days I did, and there was a lot of negative emotion, and it was just a bad situation.
That's
for
the space that I'm in. I feel conflicted because I suppose intuitively. Well, not intuitively, I just want to go out and have fun with them.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm at home, it's winter, I'm in the house. The house is always a bit messy. There's always like things to do that isn't going out and having fun with them. I mean, it might be different in the summer, but
they can have fun with each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are other options than, schooling at home or going out having fun. You could also just have fun at home.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The children are all really into Minecraft, or the younger three.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. The four-year-old, he fell and broke his arm a few weeks ago. And they say that children, after they've been ill, they can have developmental leaps. I don't know if you've ever heard of this. Especially after, I think it's specifically in the context of having a virus and getting a really big fever. They can wake up and they can read, I watched him on Minecraft. There he is. I mean, the day after he broke his arm, he's doing Lego. He broke his left arm, but he loves Lego, and he's doing Lego with his good hand and his mouth. He's improvising straight away. It's amazing how
nothing will stop him.
Yeah. Nothing will stop him. And then this Minecraft, I was watching him, and I was thinking, how do you know how to do this? That when you watch a young person that's native on a device, right? It's just like ding ding ding.
Yeah, it's crazy.
He's four, and he's just picked it up just by observing. How do I walk? You look around you and, he observes it because he sits with his older brother who watches hours of YouTube videos on how to do Minecraft.
Mm-hmm.
So he knows how to do it, but he's internally self-motivated to do so, isn't he? He really wants to.
And also, this is another thing I think we have to get over as parents, home educating parents. We think we are the educators.
Right.
We think the knowledge comes from us to the children, maybe through a book we give them or something that comes from us, but it doesn't. In reality, it comes from the curiosity of the child. They go out and explore the world. And sometimes we get to be the helper or we get to get along on the walk to the exploring. We have had so many experiences with our children now. They are a bit older now. And where we're like, how do you know that? Why? How did you? I mean, I live with them even in a van. You know, I'm with them 24/7.
You've kept this extra language.
How do you know this? I remember, and this is a long time ago, we were at the Louvre in Paris, and it was a very hot day, and we went to see the lady, as we call the Mona Lisa. We have it's like a ritual. We go to see the lady when we're in Paris. And it was just a very hot day, and you can't take off your T-shirt at the Louvre, and it was very, they have this glass ceiling, and it was like an oven. So we were like, okay, what can we do? We go to the basement. They have the... I can't say this in English. Egyptologic. How do you say it in English? Like things from old Egypt collection.
Yeah, old stuff collection. Yeah.
No. Egypt.
Things stolen from Egypt.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think
artifacts.
Artifacts from me. It's called Egyptologic, whatever.
I don't know.
We went to see things from Egypt in the basement at the Louvre. And there I am. And Storm, he is 9 and he cannot read. We're like 4 years before he can read. And he starts to lecture the whole family in a nice way. I don't know if lecture is the right word to use. But in a nice way, explaining all of us about all of the hieroglyphs. Like this one means this. And this one, you see how the head is like different. That's because 200 years later, they changed it and they changed all of them. So see, here's one original and here's one. And he was like,
How?
Well, I don't know this. Yeah. We never talked about it. We didn't watch a movie. I don't know. To this day, I don't know where he knew it from. But he knew. So I think this is what, just like we think we have to teach them to read.
Yeah.
I think the idea that we're the center of their educational universe is wrong. And this is something we have to get over.
But and it leads me...
Oh, shit, my leg is like...
It leads me on this. How do we know what we think? How do we know what our children need to live a fantastic life? How, and I remember some...
To be emotionally grounded.
One of them. Yeah. Cecilia and I talked about it at some point when we had some anxiety many years ago about being homeschoolers. And I sat down and really thought about what is it I want from my children when they are out of, not our care, but our...
in the world. Near,
yeah. Then it's like, okay, emotionally grounded is one of them. Being self-sustainable. So they don't need to be dependent on the state necessarily. They should be able to...
This is economics.
Yeah, they should need to be able to feed and put clothes and the roof over their head. And those are the two most important ones. And then for me, there's like, if they can find and nurture a passion, then life is on so many levels more easy because you just have a drive towards what you find fun. And then to, if you can ground yourself and do the other things, then I think you will be able to find love and a community around you.
Yeah, I can't disagree with any of that. I mean, amen to all of that, really.
The hard part is to let go of the idea that they also need the curriculum of math and the world history and the 3 or 4 languages and the grammar. And I find that, so in all fairness, it came from him, all the pressure in the beginning.
Yeah.
But then when we realized we're doing all this in order to serve our fear of the state, our children are paying with their time and their self-esteem. So rather we should be courageous and give them their freedom. And should the day come where the state is knocking our door and want to check on us, we will have to pick our fight and stand up for it. And until that day, let them be free and happy. And that was very easy for my husband. He could just let go. You know, he was like, I don't care if they can read and write. I don't care if they can do any math or know anything about World War, whatever. I don't care, as long as they're happy. For me, this has been harder.
Can I ask
one part of that? And then you can ask. Sorry.
We should shut up for
a while. No, no. But one part of that, I actually think, comes from me being very kind of uneducated. I had a big interest in making movies when I was like 15, 16 years old, made an amateur feature film, wanted to go to the film school and stuff like that. I only went to high school because that was my parents' only, like, you can do whatever you want, but please do this at least. Yeah. So I did that.
Because he's nice.
Yeah, but the nice boy from the suburbs, you know. Mm. But then later in life, I talked with my dad about it, about should I take a university degree? Should I go down the old normal road? And he said something to me that lingered, which was, back when I started my life, Jesper, as an adult, then what I ended up doing for the majority of my career wasn't invented when it was time to go to university.
Yeah.
And if I look at my same life, my own life, it's kind of the same. I ended up with 20 years in the media industry, but on the internet with the World Wide Website. And the ET University of Copenhagen was grounded the year I started full-time working inside that industry. So I would have had to wait 5 years to start my career. It would just have been stupid. So for me, I think the choosing not to go to university and just giving a flying fuck about it was, for me, I always believed I could make it, that I could find my way, that I didn't need a support system to do it. So when we came back to what our children needed, I was like, they don't need to go to university unless they find it fun.
I'm a really big skeptic of university now. It's very expensive to go, and I think it's terrible value for money. You should go if you love a subject, but I don't think enough people love their subject. In my line of work, I'd work with people who'd been in a line of work for maybe 20 years, and I'd ask them, how long have you enjoyed being an accountant? They say, well, never, but it pays well. I said, well, that's number one problem, you know. Yeah. And then I say to them, what are you passionate about? It's the Ikigai. Have you heard of Ikigai? Ikigai, Ikagai, it's the Japanese philosophy of, I'm doing a disservice, you'll need to look it up, but the essence of it is how to live well. And there are, if you examine these three or four, I can't remember the fourth, but the three I remember, they're very important questions. What are you passionate about? What are you good at? And what motivates you? These are kind of English interpretations, but if you look up Ikigai, it's the belief that kind of what you do with your life is at the cross section of what motivates you, what you're really passionate about, and what you're good at. And I don't think we're taught enough about, or not even taught. Yeah. So school doesn't teach you how to.
But the thing is, the whole structure of the school system doesn't, you know, it's not individual. Everybody goes through the same thing. Yeah. So it's not about what you are passionate about.
No.
That's not in the matrix of it. And yeah. I think one of the big problems of being schooled is that you don't get to find out what you're passionate about. You don't get to be bored. You don't get to feel unsettled, annoyed, frustrated because you're not fulfilled. You don't get to make bad choices about the structure of your day or your week or your year. Yeah. You don't get to realize that there's something you really need to know. You really want to know it because it was really annoying not knowing it in X, I, Y situation. Because you don't make any decisions on what you're doing. That's why it's the prison thing. You get up in the morning at a certain hour, not when you're done sleeping.
Put your uniform in.
You put on your uniform or not uniform, but you leave at a certain hour. You jump when they say jump, and you learn what they teach you you should learn. And you learn to be happy if you get the good grades and sad if you don't. And you even learn, you said before, some kids are thriving. Yeah, maybe they are. But right. they learn that, oh, I'm the one thriving.
Yeah.
You know, and they don't learn to figure out they would maybe they would rather knit all day.
Yeah.
Or sing yeah. all day.
Or go for a long walk after lunch.
They're just good at the things that you're supposed to be good at. And luck on that, what do we call it? Lucky you. You know, it's good for them. Good on them, I think you say in English.
Yeah.
But it doesn't teach even the thriving children. And they will not learn from experience what makes them happy. That's the catch
yeah.
for everyone.
It was really interesting doing my work, trying to help somebody unravel years of conditioning in six sessions. You just can't do it almost.
No.
So I would just be playful and just be interested in who they were and you know, just let the stories flow. And that's kind of why I found it fascinating, really.
Yesterday, Cecilia and I talked about ownership of your child. And because if you look at a child, do they own themselves or do you own them? A lot of kids grow up with not choosing their own clothes. Some of them grow up with not having an ownership over their own hair. Somebody tells them when their hair needs to be cut. What does that actually say to a person about being them, about how they are present in the world if they cannot decide over their own body? And with the school, they don't decide when to eat, when to go to the toilet. And it's just wild to think of how that affects you.
Yeah. And if you're homeschooling or unschooling, you might presume that you give less of a shit about what others think. You know, and so, you know, like have your kids brushed their hair and, you know, are they wearing shoes and all this kind of this fear of judgment of others?
Yeah.
But certainly I always thought that home education, you're kind of crusty and like hippie and, you know, you've got dreadlocks and you've got rainbow clothes and things like that. And there are many different ways of doing it, but I certainly, I look at my children who've got, all my children have got long hair. My youngest boy's got, you know, everybody says he's got, you know, like, oh,
same in our family. Yeah.
Yours, you know, and I just think what people say to you says more about them than it does about what they're observing. Mm-hmm. It's their own fear or projection onto the child, whether it's thinking about, oh, you know, they're not reading yet, or, you know, don't you want to cut their hair, or, you know, don't you want to wear a nice dress because you're a girl, that kind of thing. It's all on them. And actually raising children to give less of a shit about what other people think of them, I think is part of what I'm interested in.
I think it's a very nice question to find the balance, because I think also not giving a shit, not a shit at all, is that's not what I'm aiming for, because I also want for myself, being this not very nice person, and for my children to be able to balance carrying themselves as they are feeling that they are okay, and whatever they find right is right, but still caring about the people around them, how they are perceived and how comfortable people we meet or people we are in some sort of relation with, how they feel about the whole thing. I think actually, and because what we do is rare, it's more rare where we come from than it is where you come from, but it's still rare. We will always be some kind of representative of the homeschooling community. So if it's very much rainbow clothes and dreadlocks and bare feet that has not been washed for 2 years and Minecraft at the restaurant and, you know, very much of this, maybe dirty clothes, maybe things that we make a bad case for everyone else coming after us. And we don't teach the surrounding society anything good about who we are and what we're doing. So actually, I tell my children to comb their hair. And I tell them to change the t-shirt. I tell them to take a shower. I tell them to cut their nails. I'm not telling them that they have to if they like really, no, I don't want to cut my nail. I want to have long nails. Okay, it's your nails. But I will share with them the price of it, what will be perceived in the reality that we live in, because we don't live in a hippie community. We drive around in our van in all of Europe, and we find ourselves in so many different contexts. You can't take off your t-shirt at the Louvre, you'll be kicked out. And if you want to talk to people, they have to perceive you as a somewhat interesting, nice person.
Integrated. Yeah.
And you know, 3-day-old ketchup on the t-shirt is just not a good sign to send.
Yeah.
So there's a balance here. It's not all just freedom.
Yeah, you're right. It's not freedom, anarchy, and middle fingers.
That's not where I am.
Yeah. That's interesting. I was just joining some dots in my head, and I realized that I was talking about New Zealand. And part of the inspiration for travel as well, going to New Zealand, was because of somebody who I think you've recently interviewed, who's our old neighbor, Lucy. So we stayed with them in their yurt, and you know, they were they were living off grid, and they just arrived in New Zealand, and we kind of gate crashed their woofing place, and we were living in the van there and kind of hanging around and saying, how do we get around your country? But they've lived a really, you know, they were our neighbors in London, living a normal life, and they sold up and traveled around Europe first in a Volkswagen T25 and a Type 3, and you know, did that thing, and then he's a native Kiwi. But they really went brave and hard on, you know, buying a bit of land and living in a yurt and all of that.
Yeah, it's a really brave story.
Yeah, and I haven't heard the interview yet, but their bravery is very inspiring, and certainly part of our journey in giving us the confidence about knowing what you want. And it's a very personal thing to you, isn't it? Like I don't know if it's boundaries, but you know, you're like, actually, brush your hair because it's, you know, it's just going to lubricate the wheels of things. You know, this is where my boundaries are. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting and important, I think, to surround yourself with difference, otherness.
Mm-hmm.
There's not one formula for living, let alone home educating or unschooling. There are many different ways of doing it. And being around different people, I think, is really great and healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why we travel around in different cultures and meet different people. And we never really were attracted to, at least not full-time living in communities, because exactly this, they close around, you know, being right. And they are very often very right. It's just, there's not much contrast. And I think reality has many layers and levels. And it's a good thing for our children and for us to be able to, walk into the Louvre as well as, you know, sit on a beach playing guitar and having a bonfire with all the other barefoot hippies. It's just different social settings and different elements of life and different social languages, if you want.
Yeah, so it's a richness, isn't it? It's a richness. You're learning. It's like, you know, like a lot of people, if you imagine there's a spectrum of living, and most people are in here, and in there are highs and lows, and there are extremes, and of all different things of cultures and educational models and work and everything, isn't it? It's so I commend the way you're traveling. I think it's amazing. My question, I know we're almost out of time, but
let's do it.
Was to what extent was the motivation for getting up and into the van motivated by the not fear, but you know, the authorities observing us? You know, if we get in the van, they can't, you know, see you later, come and get us if you can, catch us if you can.
I think it was more the other way around. It was other things motivating us to get into the van and go,
right?
But it was a great advantage.
That's a bonus.
Yeah, we knew once we're in the van, we're safe.
See you later.
Yeah, it was see you later. It was, you know, we can just In our language, we say leave the bakery if you don't like the smell.
Yeah, but it's also the really fun.
We can leave the bakery.
The really fun thing, Martin, was, you know, in Denmark, we are less than 1%, less than a half percentage that homeschool. Right. And even unschooling is weird. And when we started back then, there were maybe 10 families maximum. Nowadays, it's getting more and more common, among others, because people share about it, more people get their eyes open. But when we were in Denmark, homeschooling our kids, unschooling them, when we talked with people about it, there was kind of, that's a little weird. That's uncommon. I haven't heard about that. What are you doing? How will your children survive? And will they ever be able to read and do math and all these things? But as soon as we started our full-time traveling, that skepticism became interest. It's like, oh man, I always wanted to travel. What a dream come true.
Oh my God, stop.
We are doing the same.
Stop it. That is absolutely what we experience so much, even when...
Well, you have the reverse situation, I suppose.
How do you mean?
That you traveled for a long time and now you're based in one place and yeah. When you get all this, how will they...
It's rather interesting just, having lived got out of the matrix. I feel like we got out of the matrix and then but we've kind of consciously gone back into it. You know, like Charlie's doing a very normal, like, you know, clever job. And I'm at home with the kids. But actually, in many ways, it's kind of like, I don't think we would have continued traveling. It's just like chapters of a book, you know, it's chapters of a book. And we're in a chapter now and we bought a wreck of a house that we'll do up and we could sell it in 2 years and move to Mexico or stay here for 20 years.
We don't know.
I don't know. I'm comfortable with not knowing.
Yeah.
Sitting with not knowing, I think, is a really...
I hope you're still staying long enough for us to come visit.
Well, we're going to be in... where are we? We're doing a little trip with all the people from the woods, actually. We're coming to the south of France, near Toulouse, in the start of September. And so I think we're going to be in France maybe for September, but here in the summer, certainly. Yeah.
We will drop
by. Perfect. Excellent.
You're going to make it.
This, definitely. I've got all the papers right this time. And I know which ones I don't have.
Okay. It was an admin error, was it? Admin.
It was admin, yeah.
Okay.
It was admin, and it was not meant to be exactly. It was just the universe, you know, knocking us in a different direction.
But this time we have a shuttle on the 17th of July, and we are coming.
Cool, lovely.
We're going to the Home Education Family Festival. Are you coming there?
Oh, where's that?
That's October in the north-ish, like 2 hours north of London.
In August, late August.
Oh, cool. I don't know about that. You have to send me the details. Yeah,
we will share them in the show notes. And we should kind of wrap up because we've been talking for hours. And
I know. I know. If anybody's still with us, thank you for listening. Lovely. It's a very personal thing, isn't it? I just feel like I've been chatting to you, but perhaps with one eye that somebody might be listening. But hopefully, it's been of interest and value to somebody.
It's been very nice to talk to you.
But it's just for me. It's just nice to connect with you again. And
likewise,
I feel like when you connect with people. And there's a nice saying. I don't know if you've heard of it. Friends are for a reason, a season, or a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you meet people and you're okay with not speaking to them all the time because you know that you'll just always know them.
Yeah. I think that's what he saw in you. Like, Jesper, he told me, like, look at that guy over there. I think he's a friend.
That's how I felt. I felt a brotherly love for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. It was just, you just know.
Yeah. Perfect. That's why I want to end this conversation on we're coming thing.
Yeah.
We are coming.
Yeah. Excellent. Lovely.
Give me months and we'll have a great hug.
Indeed. I've really enjoyed it. Okay.
Thanks a lot for your time, Martin.
Ciao, Martin.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you liked it, then please share it with all your friends and family. We would also love it if you gave our podcast a review. Thanks. And if you want to support our podcast and work, then you can find us on patreon.com/theConrad Family. We will continue to travel full time. And if you want to tag along, then please follow us on Facebook and Instagram @TheConrad Family. And you can also read more than 100 blog posts on our website, theconrad.family. Until next time,
make a wonderful day. Thank you.